For Jesus, I thank you that we can go into this wonderful book. Lord, you promised us a blessing, and you also gave us a concern that we not change one thing. So I ask, Lord, that you be with me, that I not say anything but not please you, and that you would walk among us tonight, be the breath in our words, and Lord, be every thought that comes out be from you. We love you. We invite you to be our ever-present help. In Jesus' name, amen. We are back in Revelation. We're still in chapter 2. We're in the second church of seven. Let's just do a tiny bit of a review. This is the revelation. It is singular, and it is a singular unveiling of Jesus. What this revelation is God is revealing Jesus. So this is a one humongous picture for us to look at. I know people think, when they haven't studied Revelation, that it's lots of little revelations. It's not that. If you followed before, and if you didn't, this will be new to you. John is on the Isle of Patmos. We think he's 95 to 96 years old. He is in the reign of Domitian, a Roman emperor, who put him in there as a prisoner. He's on a prison island. And he gets a first-hand visit from Jesus Christ. This book has a lot of firsts in it. It is the only place in the Bible that gives any kind of physical description of Jesus. And he doesn't look like you think. He's got white hair, and he's got bronze feet, and he's glorious and shining. And of course, we know it's his resurrected body, because this is after he had died and after he had ascended. But he shows up in Patmos, and he says basically to John, write this down. So what we're going to find is John's firsthand notes, because he is taken to look over a kaleidoscope, over a panoramic picture of the revelation, the revealing, the unveiling of Jesus by God. God tells Jesus, Jesus tells an angel, and an angel tells John, and it's kind of that way. Now, there are things you should know, that it's going to be symbols, because Jesus tells him, I'm going to signify this to you. It means I'm going to signify. I'm going to put everything in signs. What you should know, of the 404 verses in Revelation, there are over 800 Old Testament references. So we're going to be something back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And you've studied with me the prophets, so some of these are going to become very, very real to you real soon. It is a book that promises a blessing, the only book in the Bible that does. It also has an ominous warning to not change one thing. So you're going to hear, and I did say this, not going to beat this dead horse, but if you read very many commentators, especially modern ones, they will tell you it probably was not authored by John. Lies. Four times in the book it says, I, John, I, John, I, John. John was the bestie of Jesus. Right-hand man, one of the top three inner circle guys. And so he is the only disciple that was not martyred. And he's the one that Jesus entrusted with his mother at the cross. And he's the one that Jesus appears in his glorified body about 65 years after the ascension on Patmos, on the prison island, to an ancient John. And he tells John, write it down and don't change a thing. So when John's taken up in this panoramic view of the world and the very end and all that's going on, I'm sure he's spinning around trying to see everything, because it's everything from start to beginning. And I can't imagine that, because I'm in a third dimension world, and he was taken up into probably 10 dimensions, which is probably what Jesus walked in as a glorified body. So we can't even imagine. So John is troubled in that he's told not to change anything and to write it all down. So his writing style will not match St. John or 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. Because in those letters, especially in the three epistles that he wrote, he had time to think about it. He sat down and wrote letters. In St. John, he wrote notes. He could easily change his grammar. This, he's taking short, almost shorthand notes. And so you'll have commentators, modern folks, who will tell you this cannot be the same author. And then you tell them, oh, yes, it is. He tells us four times it is. And because his style is different, it's because he's put in a different situation. He's taking almost what I would say notes of a photographer or like a news person out on a station taking a story, because they have to write real fast. So their language is not going to be glorious, and there's going to be some mistakes. We get privy of having the English that some of the mistakes have been corrected and some of the punctuation has been put in. But if you're reading the Jewish part of it, if you're reading the Hebrew, mistakes are evident, and that's how God told them, don't change anything. So we're going to do that. But Jesus Christ shows up in the Isle of Patmos to ancient John, and he says, write this down. And what you're looking at in the book of Revelation is a giant letter that's going to go out to all seven churches that Jesus names specifically. Now, there were 100 churches at this time. Why these seven? We're going to hypothesize that at the end of the seventh one. I'm going to let you begin thinking why you think he chose these seven. Because there's a church in Jerusalem. There's a church in Rome. There's Philippi. I mean, there's a lot. I can start naming you churches that you know very well that are functioning probably bigger than these seven that we see here. But Jesus specifically said, write to this church, to this church. We're actually in the second church tonight. We've studied the first church he chose was Ephesus. And we're going to know that every one of these churches is going to have a certain format. He's going to tell the title of the name of the church to write. He's going to give his title. By the way, the first chapter was a linchpin for us because Jesus, in that first chapter, John wrote a whole series of names of Jesus. I'm the first and the last, the Alpha and the Omega. You start reading it. We're not going to review chapter one. You can go back and do that. But all those names that John writes in description of Jesus in that first chapter, he's going to pick those out, and he's going to cherry pick those and put those to match a certain church. And tonight we're going to prove why he names himself that name for Smyrna. Yes, he's the specificity of chapters 2 and 3 are mind-boggling. So, if you think of this as a humongous letter going out, John's writing really quickly it's to go out to all the churches. It was meant to be understood. There has been a misnomer that has circulated for centuries, and that is you can't understand Revelation. Don't study it. It's such a lie of the devil. This was hand-penned by John, dictated by Jesus, sent by God and an angel to go out. I don't know of any other book in the Bible like this, with the specific instructions to send this out to the people. We're that. We're the people. We're the church. This is meant for us. So we're going to pick it apart until you get sick of every little word being dissected, and we're going to understand it because Jesus meant for you to understand it. I believe totally you can understand this book. And after we get done, when we finish chapter 22, if I haven't done a very good job, then you'll say, ugh. But if I've done what God wants me to, you'll be your favorite book in the Bible. That's where I stand with this. It's absolutely my favorite book in the Bible. Many churches don't teach it because it has so many Old Testament references, 800 or plus 800. They don't teach the Old Testament, so it's tough for them. It's not going to be tough for you because you're Old Testament scholars. And Jesus said you could understand it. So the task before us tonight is one thing you need to review from chapter 1, only book in the Bible that outlines itself. Jesus said to John right off, here's the outline for the letter. Number 1, write the things which are, what you have seen. Number 1, things which you have seen. Well, at that point, John's thinking, what have I seen? Oh, I saw you. So he describes Jesus. Remember I told you with the wire? Go back and read the descriptions. It's really awesome. And then Jesus said, point 2 on your outline, the things which are. And that's what you're in now. You're in the point 2 of the outline. You're in the things which are, the churches. These were real churches that were in real operation in an area we now call Turkey. Back then it was called Asia. Some of us like to say Asia Minor, and they are specific churches, and they have a real location. If you took a tour, there are tours now that you can visit each of these sites. For instance, Smyrna that we're studying tonight is now Izmir, Turkey. It's a real city. When you went to Ephesus, it's no longer. And some of the others are no longer, but you can visit those ruined sites. They were real cities at this time. Remember, this is first century. This is about 95 or 96 A.D. 65 years have passed since John seen Jesus. That's probably one reason he can't remember, too. His eyes are probably worse. He's old. But it's a definite different picture of the glorified Lord. And so 65 years have passed. Anyway, so each of these churches were a specific location, and Jesus is going to name them. Then third part of the outline was the things which shall be. From chapter 4 to 22, that's all the third part of the outline. And that's where we're going to get into the tribulation. We're going to get into the center part of the tribulation. We're going to get into the very end when Jesus enters back on earth and we're on our white horses. And at the very end, we're going to see a pinch of the millennium, not much. And then we're going to see the new heaven and new earth. And let me tell you a little bit that surprised me the first time I studied this, and you already know this, but this is a little bit of a review, that the reason Revelation after the tribulation, there's real details about the tribulation. I mean, it's the most detailed book in all the Bible about the seven-year period we call the tribulation. It is so much so that you will get distressed if you don't consider, we know the ending to this. It's not all bad. But it's very little mention about the millennium. It's just kind of a brief, okay, and then there's the millennium, la-da-da. And you're thinking, wait, I need to know more. Well, John was a scholar. John was a Jew. He was raised a Jew. He had memorized Isaiah already as a boy. I mean, he's 90-something. He'd had Isaiah memorized for 75 years, as did most Jewish scholars of that time. They memorized it. So John's mindset is, I'm a Jew. I'm writing to Jews. Jews know this. I'm not wasting any pen time telling what Isaiah already told. Isaiah is your best book for the millennium. It tells you in detail all about it. And John knew that, and he wastes very little of his space. And I'm saying wasting, he just doesn't say much. You should know that as a Jew. It goes back to the very first day I taught you. It's a Jewish book written by Jewish authors to a Jewish audience, with the exception of Dr. Luke, who's Gentile, and Nebuchadnezzar, who writes one chapter in Daniel 4. So that gives a pretty good reason we're not going to get much about the millennium in this. At the very end of the study, I'm going to bring in some parts from Isaiah, because Isaiah is our master of the millennium. So that should get us kind of set up. So we're in the part two of the outline. Things which are. There are seven churches. In the book of Revelation, there's a heptatic structure. There are sevens everywhere. You can count on some scholarships, writings, you can count as many of 100 different evidences of sevens. I listened to one guy who's been dead quite a while now and said when he taught a college class, that was the assignment, and one group got up to 104, but he said, I basically cut him off and said, we got to go on to something else, because he said, I think it's endless. The seven is a perfect number for God, is completion, and so you're to see sevens everywhere. There are seven churches, no surprise. We are in church two. A little bit review about church one was the church of Ephesus. They lost their first love. They were busy, 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 busy about God's work. So busy about the work, they forgot who they were working for. So busy about the task, they forgot who the taskmaster was. And that's what we saw with Ephesus. Don't forget your first love. Now we're in what we, and by the way, that was the apostolic church in history. We think that overshadows what happened when the apostles were still on earth. That's kind of how the churches were. Now we're in the second one, Smyrna. If we could date it, it's somewhere between 100 to 313 A.D. We know from some of the people that we're going to hear about, Polycarp, for one, I want you to understand who he was as a founding father in the faith. He sat under the apostle John. And you should know him. He's historic. He's not much in the Bible, but he's historic. He was one of John's proteges, and we're going to hear about him. So the dating of this is somewhere between 100 and 313 A.D. This is the Church of Smyrna. The revelation means the unveiling of Jesus Christ. And why wouldn't part of his unveiling be his church? Because that's who we are and that's what we're supposed to do. We are going to see at the very first that this the story, the revealing was to go to the angels of the churches. You will hear commentators say that's the local pastor. Well, I disagree, but I'm a literalist. I think each church had an angel. I think each territory has angels. I think we know that from Daniel. I think we know that from the unseen realm that we're studying. And I am a literalist, so that I believe each of these churches was assigned a heavenly being that was over it. You don't have to agree with me. You can think it was the, and it may be deeper than that. It may be the local pastor too. But there's no names of local pastors. And we know that angels were always part of God's plan. They're all over the Bible. We just have to open our eyes to it. So there were seven angels assigned to seven churches. This actual town, Smyrna, moves 35 miles north of Ephesus. So we're moving right up the thing. It has a beautiful seaport, one of the most beautiful places in all of ancient Asia. In fact, it had two seaports. One was a little smaller, but they were dynamically wonderful. We know that it's Izmir, Turkey today, a town of about 300,000. But in John's time, this little town, it's not little, was 100,000 people. That's a big town for the area that we're talking about. What you should know about them is not going to make sense unless I tell you this history, so just have to bear with me, is that they were also a center for pagan worship. They had as their main little g god a goddess of Roman worship named Cybele. Cybele, somebody calls her, but I call it Cybele. And she was a goddess of fertility and sexual deviancy. You might as well call it what it is. And yet on this path to the seaport was a beautiful walkway. And they had many gods, from Cybele to Apollo to the very end. They had one for Zeus. And these were all statues. So they were kind of known as a capital for pagan worship of lots of entities. So when the early Christians began forming there, and we believe it was Paul that came as an apostle that set up Christianity, there was a very big group of Christians that began to gather at Smyrna. There was also a very big group of Jews that did not become Christians, and they were Jews. But it was accepted there because there were lots of gods. You want to worship Jehovah God? Yeah, go for it. You want to worship Jesus? Sure. You want to worship Zeus? Absolutely. How about Cybele? Yes. What about Apollo? They even had a statue out in the seaport, just to cover all their bases, of Neptune. So they were known for pagan worship. They had beautiful statues and memorials for those. Now, it became logical then that when the Roman Empire took over Smyrna, that because they were so open to God and goddess worship, that Caesar began to take precedence in the Roman Empire. He was the type, and his family was the type, that they were pretty full of themselves, and they began to think they should be worshipped. So when they began to place themselves on the level of demanding worship, it was fairly easy for the people at Smyrna to do that. After all, why not have a statue to Caesar? He put him along that causeway, along with all the other statues. And as you're going by, you could just have Cybele there, and you could have Caesar, and you could have Apollo, and you could have Zeus. Just add him along. You want to add a statue to the Jewish God? Go for it. You want to add a statue to Jesus? If you want one, do it. I mean, they were real open to all this worship. So Caesar steps in this gorgeous town, one of the prettiest ancient towns because of their seaport. And he began saying, I think I need to have a temple and a shrine built for me. So he set up sort of a contest between towns in the area to see who could satisfy him most with the structure they could build. And of all the towns that vied for this great honor to build a temple and a shrine to Caesar, Izmir, Turkey, today, or Smyrna, ancient, won. So they began erecting this wonderful temple-ish pagan deity place for Caesar. And Caesar was pleased. This is one of the prettiest towns around. It's large, too. And he actually, at one point, considered it being one of the capitals of the Roman Empire. And it didn't happen, but it was a really important place that a lot of the high-ups did vacation there because of the seaport. So in 26 AD, they had this competition to build this temple. And it was to Tiberius Caesar. There are lots of Caesars. This one that instigated this, his name was Tiberius. Now, he actually followed Octavius. So if you're a history buff, those will date this pretty plainly. That's why we can date these things, because history keeps a pretty good record of the dates of this. And they build this gorgeous, gorgeous thing. Well, the next logical step is, if you are Caesar and you are pagan and you are not loving the true God, which we know they didn't, then naturally you want people to start worshiping you. And after all, you've got a beautiful town, you've got a beautiful center, you've got a beautiful temple, you've got beautiful statues. So your next step is, well, people better start worshiping you. Well, how do they do that? So they instigate this thing where they have incense, they have a burning fire, like most temples did have a fire pit of some kind. And they had incense there. And to make it real simple for the people, they simply said, I tell you what, once a year you come before this gorgeous temple, this gorgeous picture of me, I'm talking in as if I'm Caesar, this gorgeous statue of me, and you all have a fire pit there, and you just take a pinch of incense and you put it in the fire and you say, Caesar is the one true God. That's all you have to do. And then I'll give you a certificate every year that you have met all the requirements of a Roman citizen, and you can buy commerce, and you can trade, you can sell your goods, and you'll be clear for a year. Every year, every adult in your family needs to come forward to this temple, and my priests will document that you've done this. Well, that goes well for everyone who worships Apollo, or who worships Sibyl, or if you worship Zeus, or if you worshiped some littler god. You probably don't mind saying Caesar's the one true God and throwing incense in the fire. You probably don't mind that because you might be polytheistic. You might worship several gods. I mean, Zeus doesn't care. You can worship 10 gods if you want to. Sibyl doesn't care. Caesar doesn't care. You can worship all these other gods, but you have to once a year come. And you have to say, Caesar's the one true God. Throw your incense in honor to him, and the high priest will write you a certificate. That didn't work well for Christians. Because here's the problem with that. Jesus is the one true God. And he said, I will have no other gods before me. And if you're a devout Jew, it doesn't work well for you either. Because God is a jealous God. And so what happens then is, if you don't do that, you don't get your certificate from the high priest. Therefore, you can't do commerce in the city. People won't sell to you, and they won't buy your products. And that's the market society that the Smyrnians lived in. They were agriculture, they were seafarers, they had fish, they had oysters. I mean, they had textiles. But you have to be able to move your goods to get goods back for your family. And if you didn't do the Caesar worship in the beautiful temple, then you weren't given the right to buy and sell. It reminds you a little bit of tribulation times, doesn't it? And that didn't go too well. And then what happens is it gets a little bit tougher. Because what happens next is Caesar's a little bit ticked that there are actually people that won't do that. He's thinking, my goodness, I've given you this gorgeous city. My soldiers protect you from enemies. You've got the most beautiful place to live. You've got a beautiful temple. And I ask you one simple thing. Come in, throw a pinch of incense in that fire, and say I'm God. That's all you have to do. That's all I ask for you all year long. And so he begins getting angry. If you know anything about the Caesars, they're nothing if they're not irrational. And irrational leaders make stupid laws, such as, if you don't do that, you get to burn at the stake. And so this begins setting you up for what happens to Polycarp. And I'm going to save that story for just a little bit, but I wanted to explain the whole situation of Smyrna. You need to understand another thing about Smyrna. It is from the Greek word myrrh. You may have heard of it. It is a gum solution that comes from trees that when that is crushed, it makes off an odor. It's used for medicinal purposes because it's a number. It's a narcotic of sorts so that it numbed pain. It was used for cleansing for women and babies, a kind of an ointment. It had a beautiful smell, but that had to be crushed to release the odor, and it was used for embalming. You will remember that when the Magi came to see baby Jesus in the Bethlehem stable, they brought him three gifts: gold for the king, frankincense for the prophet, and myrrh for his burial. It was a strange gift to give a baby. But you see, they'd been set up by Daniel 700 years before that and knew what they were looking for. And the myrrh is very expensive to this day, because to make it its best, there's a lot of process it has to go through. It has to be crushed. To be the best it can be, it has to be crushed. I think you begin to see what Smyrna means. It means to be its best, they must be crushed. And there's just no accidents in the words in the Bible. So that tells you a little bit. With all the idolatry everywhere, there was actually an ancient, and I just am a history buff, so I thought you might like to know, there's actually an ancient theater to Zeus that seated 20,000 people. Now, this isn't ancient times, guys. This isn't about 180. John's in his late 90s. And he's writing this letter to this town. So get a picture of who are. They're gorgeous. They're beautiful. Now, people that were having no problem worshiping Caesar were very, very rich. The commerce was excellent because they had seaport traffic and they could send their goods out. But remember, if you didn't get the certificate from the high priest, you didn't get to do that. So the people that were true Jews or that were true Christians were poor. They were very poor because they had no place to trade. Remember, traffic back then was walking. So to get their goods places, they were not allowed to use the seaports. They didn't have their certificate. They were not allowed to set up in the centers where all the, quote, little g god things were set up where people walked, because they didn't have a certificate. And so in Smyrna, you're either very rich or you're very poor. And the devout believers were very, very poor. That's the other story you need to know. Now, the secular Jews that lived in Smyrna didn't have any trouble going and putting their pinch of incense for Caesar, and they didn't mind saying Caesar's the only true God because they were secular Jews. We know them today. They live in New York. They don't have a clue who Jehovah God is, and they don't worship the one true God. That was always true. There were always people that took the name of Jew that were not real. And Jesus is going to address them too. So when you crush the myrrh, the seeds for the myrrh, you get the beautiful smelling, beautiful, beautiful smell. And also the medicinal purposes. The allegory here is pretty easy to see, that without the suffering, without the crushing, there's no benefit. We should take note, and this is something that we'll learn later on in the New Testament. When Jesus died, Nicodemus asked for his body, and he was given it. History tells us that he took 100 pounds of myrrh and anointed his crushed body and wrapped it in linen. Very expensive. Jesus.
Oh, okay.
When Jesus died, Nicodemus took that and he spent probably his whole fortune to do that. But that's myrrh. So we're going to relate Jesus and myrrh all the time. And Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus were the two that did that. We know for a fact that to have someone give the body to someone in those times, Joseph of Arimathea had to be related to Jesus, or Pilate wouldn't have released his body to him. We don't know how. We think a cousin, an uncle removed or something. We're not sure about that. We know he's related. So that, another thing. When Polycarp is martyred, and I want to say that for a little bit. You're going to know that he's not the only one martyred. There were, at least at one time, there were 1,500 Christians martyred because they wouldn't do the incense to Caesar and declaim that he was God. And then later on in history, there's another 1,200. These were the true Christians and the true Jews. And so that gives you a little setup about this letter to Smyrna. I think maybe you know a little bit about it. Now, a review. Every letter is going to have the name of the church, the title that Christ chooses from chapter 1 for himself that relates to this. It's going to have something good said about them. It's going to have a concern. Usually it's prefaced by nevertheless. It's going to have a little exhortation or advice given to them. And then it's going to have a promise to the overcomer. Usually it's going to end with he that hath an ear. And that would be the last closing of this letter. So the churches at Smyrna and Philadelphia are going to have one thing in common. We're going to learn that by the end of this lesson. They're the only two that will have this one thing in common. So we know then that the church of Smyrna is called the martyred church, because these people had to endure persecution if they didn't do the little worship of the Caesars. There is going to be satanic opposition on every front for these people, because he hits them in their commerce, he hits them in their living, he hits them in their life. Satan attacks these persecuted Christians to no end. And actually, that root word Smyrna means death. This is the embalming spice that has to be crushed. It is interesting, and I do like to tell you all that I know that relates. The three gifts that the wise men brought, baby Jesus, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, he's given in the millennial period. We find out by Isaiah that he's actually, when he's become the King of Kings and Lord of Lords over the whole earth, he's in the temple, and he's brought gifts. Guess what he's brought? Gold and frankincense. There is no myrrh given to him in the millennium. You know why? Because death's behind him. There's no death anymore. And so we know that every word's for a purpose. But this word, Smyrna, means death. Gives you an idea about this church, doesn't it? Okay, we're going to start. I'm in Revelation 2. And I'm just starting with verse 8. And unto the angel of the church in Smyrna write. Again, I want to point out to you that angel is angel. I don't have to make it anybody else. I'm a literalist, so I believe John is giving instructions to these heavenly entities that are over each of these sections, and he's telling them what Jesus wants them to know for their particular church that they've been made charge of. Okay? These things saith the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. Now, this is Jesus' title. And isn't it interesting that he uses in this title, who was dead and is alive? He uses that word death, that Smyrna word, for his title. Because guess what? That is who he is. The title of Jesus, the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. And when you pick apart what that Greek word alive means, it actually means resurrected. Jesus is saying, write down my title to these people so they have some hope. I was dead, and I resurrected. That's going to be their story too. Maybe Caesar will kill them. Maybe he will. He did a lot of them. And we know history tells us that he did. But Jesus said, but they will be alive. They will be resurrected. And that's the promise in that word alive in his title. Because Christians that refused in the latter part of this reign of the Caesars were burned at the stake. That was their execution of choice. By this point, Rome has moved past the crucifixion model of execution, which was barbaric in itself, but it took too long. I mean, Jesus actually died faster than most other prisoners. That was God. But typically, it could take him 2 or 3 days to die up on the cross. And Rome said, not with that. We'll just burn him at the stake. They're gone in 15 minutes. And so they moved their model of execution up to, by this point in time, 65 years past Jesus' execution, they're burning at the stake. That's what Rome did. So the title was The First and Last, which was dead and is alive. And if you're filling out your charts, which we do for each one, then you'll know that. Just a point of interest, because I think it's important, and I'm going to let you guess on this. I bet you know the answer. How many times do you think the term first and last occur in the Bible? 7. You got it. And when Jesus uses it, it is by no mistake. He purposely tells you that. And he's writing to Smyrna. He's writing to these Christians that are struggling. They're being persecuted by Rome. They will not take the mark, so to say, of worshiping Caesar. And he's saying, that's okay, I'm the first and I will be the last. God. There is no other. And I was dead, but I'm resurrected and now I'm alive. And that's your promise too. And that's all that he's saying in that opening to them. It's kind of a promise right off the bat to them. And I'm sure they got that. Remember, these Jews who are getting this letter from John have read in the Bible 6 other times in the Old Testament, first and last. That's always a symbol of God Almighty. I am the first. I am the last. And so they know the promises that he's saying here. So don't give up. And that occurs 7 times. I'm in verse 9 of chapter 2. I know this goes slow, but we're only doing a few verses, so we're just doing one church. So I want you to know everything you can about Smyrna. Revelation 2:9. Here is what Jesus is going to, this is what he knows about them. He always is going to tell the church, I've seen you. And this is what he says to them. I know thy works and tribulation and poverty. Remember their story. They've tried to serve him. They've tried to stay true. And why are they so broke and so impoverished? Because they haven't taken this mark. They haven't done the worship. They haven't gotten the certificate. And therefore, they can't buy and sell except among each other. They can't trade with anyone else. Because to do shipping and trading, to trade on the Roman road, you had to have a certificate. You couldn't set up a little booth. You couldn't have a farmer's market without your certificate. They are poor. They are what we would call the working poor today. I mean, they're trying to scrap together and get their food and their clothing, but they're having to do it in their small group because no one else will trade with them. And he says that. He said, I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. And what would he mean by that? He looks in their heart of hearts, and he's seen their loyalty. And Jesus said to John, write this down. To me you are rich. Remember, we are going to be priests and what else with Jesus? Kings. In the hereafter, in the millennial, when they stay true, when they march into the millennium with King Jesus, they are going to be kings and priests. And he says, look past today, you're going to be rich. You are rich. You're the child of a king, and I'm raising you up in this tribulation and poverty to be a king. That's what he's saying there. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Now, we'll go back to what their story is. Remember, I told you there were secular Jews, lots of them living in this period. And they would, year after year, step right up to that pagan altar and put that pinch of incense right on there for Caesar and take their paper because they're secular Jews. There were actually a few really honest, good Jews that wouldn't do it. They were few. Most of the Jews are like the rich, quote, Jews we know today that are secular. They're not taking on the cause of God Almighty, Jehovah God. They're making the money, and they're trading, and they're marketing, and that's what he sees here. And Jesus says, I see you. I see you Jews, quote, you call yourself that. But what does he call them? He says, you know the synagogue that you're putting the pinch of incense on for Caesar? You're worshiping in the synagogue of Satan. Because, after all, Caesar was a false god who had as his compatriot Satan himself. Satan set up all those false gods, Apollo and Zeus and Aphrodite and Sibyl. They were Satan's minions. So was Caesar. And God says to them, I know the blasphemy of them, which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. I see you every year where you, quote, take the mark. You sell your soul so you can become rich and trade and not be in trouble and not burn at the stake. I see you. But you true Smyrnians, you may be poor on this earth. You may think you're poverty, but you're rich. Because in my kingdom, you're going to be a king. And I hope you're getting to get the picture of what the people, the true believers in Smyrna were doing. You see how the name works? They were being crushed by everything around them. They were like the myrrh seeds that had to be crushed for the aroma. And so their sweet aroma, God's saying, as you're being crushed and not taking that mark and not worshiping Caesar, as you're being crushed, your sweet aroma is coming up to me and I see you. And you're rich. Because I'm writing it all down. In my kingdom, you'll be kings. And that's their commendation. I see your works. Now, the synagogue of Satan, I have to put something in here that you must know. John wrote Revelation. I know you know that, but let me pair this up. When John was writing this letter that Jesus was dictating to him, and John's writing this down, he goes, oh, I'm sure he's thinking, I know this story. Because in John 8, this happened. When Jesus was alive, before he was crucified, if you read John 8 and you understand what is said there, there is a tit for tat, back and forth, that goes between Jesus and the Pharisees. That is one of the most interesting dialogues that happens in all the Bible. And it starts out where Jesus is with his disciples and the Pharisees start making derogatory remarks about his mother. I mean, we can think of what she's not married. She wasn't married when she had you. We call her And they were going on, and Jesus turns on them. And it is, I'm going to read some of it to you, but you have to know the setup for this. He basically says, oh yeah, if you question my father, you're of your father, the devil. He's a viper. You are like your father. And basically saying, you're from the synagogue of Satan, which he's calling these Jews here in Smyrna. So John knows this story. John knows when Jesus is telling him to write to Smyrna, to be encouraged because he knows their poverty, he knows what they're going through, that he knows these people in the synagogues, and they're Jews. They're the Pharisees that put Jesus down and called his mother a whore, that called him a bastard son, and that Jesus turned on them and called them of their father a viper. So let's read that. I want to read that to you from John 8. Abraham is our father, Jesus said to them. If you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth, which I heard from God. Abraham did not do this. You do the deeds of your father. Then they said to him, we were not born of fornication. See, they're making fun of his mother. They're putting her down. We have one father, God. Jesus said to them, if God were your father, you would love me. For I proceeded forth and came from God, nor have I come of myself, but he sent me. Why do you not understand my speech? Because you are not able to listen to my word. You are of your father, the devil. and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. And he goes on, and that was John 8, starting with 39. He goes on to call him from their father the viper, which we know that the Satan is called a snake, a serpent, a dragon. We know he's reptilian because of the descriptions in the Bible about Leviathan. All those descriptions of him are from Old Testament descriptions. We know what he looks like. And this right here, this dialogue back and forth, John wrote that down. He was privy to that fight between Jesus and these Pharisees about Jesus' mother. And so when he's writing this dictation down to the letter to Smyrna, he realizes Jesus is saying the same thing to these quote Jews from the synagogue of Satan, because they are from their father, the devil. This is the same spirit that's surrounding these Jews in Smyrna that take the mark every year, to the same ones that were trying to call Mary a fornicator. And see, John knows this because he wrote both. So if you get a chance to go back and read John 8, it is one of the most interesting dialogues that John was firsthand privy to. So, I mean, it's pretty interesting. And if people say Jesus didn't get mad, oh, I differ with you. He was very angry at these guys and justified so. A true Jew, which John considered himself a true Jew. You remember, these are the early converts. Peter, James, John, Andrew, Bartholomew. They were Jews. Yes, they loved Jesus, and we call them now Christians. But in their minds, until about a century into that, they considered themselves Jews. So when Jesus is talking to the synagogue of Satan Jews, John knows exactly who he means. He means those that are just playing church. We may have Christians that do that. They just show up to the synagogue, put their dollar in the offering plate, drink their little juice, and consider themselves good, and go out and do every sort of despicable thing that Jesus would be totally against. It's the same spirit. The Satan doesn't have anything new. He just recycles it over and over and replays it again, and stupid human beings buy it. That's what's happening here at Smyrna with this synagogue of Satan, the Jews, that he's talking about. So you understand now what their problem was, right? Okay. I am in Revelation. That's a long thing for one verse. We're in Revelation 2:10. But here's the exhortation he's going to tell them. Remember, he said, I know your works. I know what's happening here. And I know who these Jews are. But here's what he says in Revelation 2:10. Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you in prison. He names them. Who's doing this? Sure, it's the Romans, and sure, it's those other Jews. But Jesus says it's the devil doing it. We know who the author of this is. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that you may be tried. And ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. There's a lot in that one verse. I want to pick that apart for you. So the concern for Smyrna, in our letterhead that we do for each church, you're going to note something really unique in the church of Smyrna. He has no concerns for them. They're not doing anything wrong. But he does say this to them. Don't fear anything. Number one, he says there's going to be a lot of you thrown into prison, which was true. The devil does that. He threw Paul into prison. All the disciples, I think, except for John, were thrown into prison. Some are beheaded. I don't think Thomas was. I think he was stabbed in a temple. But most were thrown in prison and then killed. So the devil doesn't have anything new. The 10 days is an interesting phrase. The nearest, I'm going to tell you, there's two takes on that. When he says this, he says, you shall have tribulation 10 days. Most modern scholars believe that designates a short amount of time. Smyrna is not going to last very long. And a lot of these people are going to be killed. So he's basically saying, bear with it. Hold the line. You're going to be with me, and it's not going to last very long. That's one take. And it may mean that. Because I do think in prophecy, and we know this is a book of prophecy, Jesus said it was, it can mean several things. A more interesting take on this is that there were 10 persecutions by Rome. Let me name them for you. Nero in 34 to 68. We know him because he beheaded Paul, crucified Peter upside down. You may remember him. About 5 million Christians were martyred during the time of Nero. Real despicable despot he was. Then Domitian. This is the time that John's writing, about AD 95-96. He's the one that threw John into the prison at Patmos. So he's number two. In the year 104 to 117, we have Trajan. And there's a martyr by the name of Ignatius. If you study the first century fathers of the church, he's a real hero of the faith. He was burned at the fire. By that time, they changed to burning the stake because it was much quicker. The fourth awful, I'm going to call him, was Marcus Aurelius from 161 to 180. And this is kind of like, if you ever saw the Gladiator movie, it's that period where they threw the Christians to the lions and that kind of picture. That's what was really true. Polycarp is burned at the stake there, and we're going to talk about him in just a minute. And then number five, remember I'm trying to give you the 10 days or the 10 bad things that happened. Okay, 200 to 211, Septus Severus, and he killed Irenaeus, another one of those like Polycarp, heroes of the faith. Some of these guys sat under John and were his students, his charges, if you will. Number six. 235 to 237, Maximinus, he killed Ursula and Hippolytus. You'll hear me talk about Hippolytus. I refer to his writings a lot because he's a pretty good historian too, but a devout Christian. In 249 to 251, there's Decius. In 257 to 260, there's Valerian. In number 9, in 270 to 275, is Aurelian. And in 10, there's 303 to 323 is Diocletian. And he was the worst of the bunch. Absolutely awful. We know that 5 million Christians died during that time. Now, I'm going to take you on a little side trip so that you understand why I keep talking about Polycarp. Jesus mentions, there's a real hint to him in this section, because he was, after John traveled to Ephesus, before he was imprisoned, he set up Polycarp as the bishop of Smyrna. He sat under John and was one of his students, and you should know him. I know the Bible doesn't name him, but history does, and he's worth talking about. So let me tell you a little bit about him. He is a picture of both persecution and courage. Let's talk a little bit about him. Polycarp was a remarkable example of persecution and the courage of early Christians. The year after Polycarp returned from Rome, a great persecution came upon the Christians of Smyrna. His congregation urged him to leave the city until the threat blew over. So, believing that God wanted him to be around a few more years, Polycarp left the city and hid out on a farm belonging to some Christian friends. One day on the farm, as he prayed in his room, Polycarp had a vision of his pillow engulfed in flames. He knew that God said to him and calmly told his companions, "I see that I must be burnt at the stake." I'm going to stop here and say this is well documented and is written in Polycarp's journals. We have this knowledge because he wrote it. Meanwhile, the chief of police issued a warrant for his arrest. You might ask why at this point. He would not put the incense at the altar for Caesar. So no surprise, is it? He wouldn't do it. This is the point where Rome had changed and now is beginning to persecute those who wouldn't. They seized one of Polycarp's servants and tortured him until he told them where his master was. Towards evening, the police chief and a band of soldiers came to the old farmhouse. When the soldiers found him, they were embarrassed to see that they had come to arrest such an old, frail man. History tells us he's about 102 years old at this point. We know for a fact he writes that he's been saved 86 years. We think he's about 102. They reluctantly put him on a donkey and walked him back to the city of Smyrna. On the way to the city, the police chief and other government officials tried to persuade Polycarp to offer a pinch of incense before a statue of Caesar and simply say, "Caesar is Lord." That's all he had to do, and he would be off the hook. They pleaded with him to do it and escape the dreadful penalties. At first, Polycarp was silent. Then he calmly gave them his firm answer, "No." The police chief was now angry. Annoyed with the old man, he pushed him out of his carriage and onto the hard ground. Polycarp, bruised but resolute, got up and walked the rest of the way to the arena. The horrid games at the arena had already begun in earnest, and a large, bloodthirsty mob gathered to see Christians tortured and killed. One Christian named Quintus boldly proclaimed himself a follower of Jesus and said he was willing to be martyred, but when he saw the vicious animals in the arena, he lost courage and agreed to burn the pinch of incense to Caesar as Lord. Another young man named Germanus didn't back down. He marched out and faced the lions and died an agonizing death for his Lord. 10 other Christians gave their lives that day. But the mob was unsatisfied. They cried out, "Away with the atheists who do not worship our gods!" To them, Christians were atheists because they did not recognize the traditional gods of Rome and Greece. Finally, the crowd started chanting, "Bring out Polycarp!" When Polycarp brought his tired body into the arena, he and the other Christians heard a voice from heaven. It said, "Be strong, Polycarp, play the man." As he stood before the proconsul, they tried one more time to get him to renounce Jesus. The proconsul told Polycarp to agree with the crowd and shout up, "Away with the atheists!" Polycarp looked sternly at the bloodthirsty mob, waved his hands toward them, and said, "Away with those atheists!" The proconsul persisted, "Take the oath and revile Christ, and I'll set you free." Polycarp answered, "For 86 years I've served Jesus. How dare I now revile my king?" The proconsul finally gave up and announced to the crowd the crime of the accused. "Polycarp has confessed that he is a Christian." The crowd shouted, "Let the lions loose!" But the animals had already been put away. The crowd then demanded that Polycarp be burnt. The old man remembered the dream about the burning pillow and took courage in God. He said to the executioners, "It is well. I fear not the fire that burns for a season and after a while is quenched. Why do you delay? Come, do your will." They arranged a great pile of wood and set up a pole in the middle. As they tied Polycarp to the pole, he prayed, "I thank you that you have graciously thought me worthy of this day and of this hour, that I may receive a portion in the number of martyrs and the cup of your Christ." After he prayed and gave thanks to God, they set the wood ablaze. A great wall of flame shot up to the sky, but it never touched Polycarp. God set a hedge of protection between him and the fire. Seeing that he would not burn, the executioner, in a furious rage, stabbed the old man with a long spear. Immediately, streams of blood gushed from his body and seemed to extinguish the fire. When this happened, witnesses said they saw a dove fly up from the smoke into heaven. At the very same moment, a church leader in Rome named Irenaeus said he heard God say to him, "Polycarp is dead." God called his servant home. If that doesn't give you a picture of Smyrna, and if that doesn't give you a picture of Jesus, who was myrrh itself, death crushed to be the perfect aroma to Christ, then I haven't explained theirs very well to you. And finally, what we have to know is that there the promise to the overcomer is the finish of the story of Smyrna. And he says in verse 11, He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. And why do we care? Because we're all going to die once. We just are. Unless we're raptured. Still counting on that. And then I think you die in your place and get your new body immediately. But the second death you don't want. That's when you're thrown into the lake of fire. That's hell itself at the very end. And we see the picture with Polycarp and with Irenaeus and Hippolytus and the 1,500 that followed Polycarp and the 1,200 that followed after that would not bow their knee to Caesar, that would not take the mark of the beast, that would not say Caesar is Lord, that proclaimed Jesus as they died. He said, you're like a sweet myrrh that's being crushed, and the incense of your odor is wafting up to God in this glorious picture, because you will be kings with me someday. You need to understand, too, he promises them a crown. And you need to understand that in the Bible, there are more than one crown. We know that there, in fact, let me give you a picture of what you would have seen if you'd have walked into the arena. They put fake crowns on sometimes, the people that were being eaten. But the king wore a certain crown. And then there were other crowns that were worn by, quote, unquote, dignitaries. That's not the crowns we're talking about. These are the crowns that you receive as a reward after you go to be with Jesus. There is the crown of life. James talks about it, and Revelation 2. So I believe Polycarp received that. I believe the martyrs received that crown of life. There's the crown of righteousness. We see that in 2 Timothy. And basically, those who loved his appearing. I'm going to get that one, because I get up every morning watching for him. I want his appearing. That's a crown you get. That's a crown of righteousness. There's the crown of glory. Peter talks about those who fed the flock. If you're helping other Christians learn and grow, that's your crown. You get the crown of glory. Then there's the crown incorruptible. Those who press on steadfastly. I would say that were the Smyrnians. Without food, in poverty, being persecuted by Rome, being burned at the stake, being crushed on all sides, they got the crown of the incorruptible. And then there's the crown of the rejoicing in 1 Thessalonians. Those who win souls. If you are leading people to Jesus, then you get the crown of rejoicing. Now, there may be other crowns, and someone guessed, and that's totally a guess, so I might as well guess it too, maybe thousands of them, because God writes it all down. And we know these five for sure, and we see that Smyrna definitely is receiving a crown. And why do we care about Smyrna? It is the martyr church. Yeah, we're pretty posh here in America. I don't know if any of my friends have been martyred for Christ. But then I don't live in Zimbabwe and Arab countries and Egypt. I don't live any of those places. I think if you lived in Eastern Africa or Northern Arabia, you might have a different story. I think if you've lived in Iraq and Iran, probably you'd really be able to feel the crushing of martyrdom. Just saying. The promise in Revelation 2 says this, to him that overcometh will I give to eat of the tree of life. This was for Ephesus, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. That's one of the promises. And the promise tonight was, he that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. The promises, promises, promises. And they can all be ours. So Father, I thank you for the persecuted church of Smyrna. I thank you that we get a picture of Jesus, who is definitely myrrh. And we get a picture that when he's on the cross and the guard offers him myrrh mixed with sour wine, which is a pain reliever, he said, no, thank you. I'm being crushed for you. And I thank you for people like Polycarp, who decided you were worth it. So, Father, I ask that you let us take tonight's lesson, that we be all that we can be for you, and that you would be glorified. If anyone's listening to this, message, and it is not know you a Savior that they give someone a call, that they ask you tonight, don't wait another minute, that you would go in their hearts. In Jesus' name, amen.